Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchik. In this episode, we'll hear excerpts from presentations from Media Democracy Day, organized by the Metro Chicago Progressive Media Network in Chicago on November 7, 2009. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report, but now, a collection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. Comcast, the largest cable and residential broadband provider in the country, announced Thursday morning that they are going to purchase a controlling stake in NBC Universal, one of the largest media companies in the world. If approved by federal regulators, this merger would create a media behemoth that reaches hundreds of millions of homes and stretches across content production and distribution, movie and television studios, and broadcast television stations. The merger, which will be the first deal of its scope and size under the Obama administration, is strongly opposed by public interest and consumer groups like Consumer Federation of America, Media Access Project, and Free Press, unions like the Communication Workers of America, and smaller cable companies represented by the American Cable Association. Josh Stearns is program manager of Free Press. He says that this merger would put incredible power into the hands of one company. But this won't just impact diversity on the airwaves. The deal will also hit our wallets.
It's going to raise prices, it's going to limit competition, and it's going to open the door for a whole new wave of mega media mergers.
In an era where online video is on the rise, the merger could spell disaster for consumer choice in online video platforms like Hulu, Netflix, iTunes, and others.
We're likely to see Comcast begin to clamp down on NBC and Comcast content, which is going to really inhibit the growth of these online video projects. We could imagine a time when Comcast began limiting people's access to NBC content or to Comcast content online unless they were a Comcast subscriber. So picture this. If you want to watch 30 Rock, you better be a Comcast subscriber. That's how it could be if you want to get 30 Rock online.
Free Press is rallying public opposition to the deal. Stearns explains that stopping media consolidation was a key part of President Obama's media and technology campaign platform. His administration's response to the merger will be an important test.
We need a public outcry like we've never heard before to stop this deal in its tracks.
To find out more about the Comcast-NBC merger, visit freepress.net/Comcast.
Entertainment companies have slashed budgets to the bone, leaving fewer new scripted programs in the nightly lineup and a lot of writers and actors out of work. Many are migrating to the internet. The web is giving them a chance for success unavailable in the legacy network system. Actress Ruth Livier knew her ingenue days were coming to an end. She began acting at 15 and had a successful 3-year run on Showtime's Resurrection Boulevard. After 15 years in the business, she took scriptwriting classes with the hope of writing a TV pilot. She came up with a bilingual show about a small-time Mexican-American talk show host named Ilse, spelled Y-L-S-E, but realized it would never make it onto a network. She retooled it for the web, got a small crew together, and began production.
I didn't want it sitting on my bookshelf. I've heard so many scripts end up just sitting on shelves. And this was an opportunity to go out there and produce it and distribute it on a worldwide basis. So I've got subtitles in English and subtitles in Spanish, since the original version is bilingual. And that way, I think it just even broadens our potential audience base.
The first year, Ilse could be found on its own website, ilse.net, and on YouTube. Now in its second season, the show is hosted on a number of sites, including Blip TV and Cine Dulce. Livier says content creators are finding each other through these new web channels.
That's also one of the exciting things on the web, that people from across the country, people that are creating channels, have found Ilse and have asked me if they could host the show. And for us, it is a win-win because we get their audience to be a part of their lineup with the audience that they already have built in. And for them, it's the same. They bring Ilse audiences to their site.
Livier is hopeful that these new online video channels will soon be attracting advertisers. But right now, the name of the game is inexpensive production and distribution, which is all web-based. And for that, she needs an open, neutral, and fast internet. Being completely independent, she says there would have been no way that she could afford to do this otherwise.
Because the net is free, then I can distribute it worldwide, and then I get to compete for eyeballs and for hits just on the basis of the quality of the content. People are coming on board because they like the show, but I needed to get the show out there for people to be excited about it and want to be a part of it and support it.
For Livier, access is the key for content providers and for viewers.
Right now, the way the internet is, we have net neutrality. And if they change it, then the user's not going to have control of the internet. It's going to be the powers that be who are going to decide what we can or can't watch, should or shouldn't watch. And I think that's fundamentally wrong.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
The United States Congress's chief responsibility is to make laws, but the legislative branch of government often behaves as if it does not understand or respect the rule of law. In its treatment of the grassroots activist organization ACORN, Congress has acted like a mob, whipped into an hysteria by Republicans and their servants in the corporate media. Back in September, Congress voted to halt all government payments to ACORN, including millions in contracts for counseling poor and middle-income people on ways to avoid losing their homes. The anti-ACORN legislation was spurred by wall-to-wall broadcast coverage of a video showing isolated cases of ACORN office workers giving casual business advice to a white couple posing as a pimp and his prostitute. Only 75 congresspersons, including 29 members of the Congressional Black Caucus, voted against the measure to defund ACORN, which President Obama signed into law on October 1st. So it comes as somewhat of a surprise that Obama's Justice Department has taken the position that the federal government should honor the contracts it entered into with ACORN, despite the Congress's actions. Essentially, the Justice Department takes much the same position as a suit brought by ACORN that claims the defunding legislation should be considered an illegal punishment of specific people and groups by Congress. That's called a bill of attainder, and it is prohibited by the U.S. Constitution. Justice Department lawyers wrote the legal opinion back on October 23rd, but the memo was only posted last week. The lawyers recommended that the government honor its contracts and continue making payments to ACORN, which has collected about $53 million for services rendered to governmental agencies since 1994. ACORN's suit to keep its contracts names as defendants the U.S. Secretary of the Treasury, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and the head of the Office of Management and Budget. The newly released Justice Department memo reads like a friend of the court brief in favor of ACORN's position. But one should not jump to the conclusion that the Obama administration, which signed off on the anti-ACORN legislation, has had a sudden change of heart. Rather, this is almost certainly a case of the executive branch protecting itself from congressional efforts to defund organizations employed by the federal government. Organizations like the Mercenary Outfit, formerly known as Blackwater, for example. ACORN wrote the book on stabilizing poor and working-class neighborhoods under siege by predatory lenders, long before the financial crash. For many years, ACORN was the authoritative source on the looming subprime housing catastrophe, abetted by both Democrats and Republicans in Congress and the White House. When Acorn's message turned out to be horrifically accurate, members of both parties tried to kill the messenger. Regardless of its motives, the Justice Department legal position on the Acorn suit is beneficial to the people's interests. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stjepanczyk. We now feature excerpts from presentations from Media Democracy Day, organized by the Metro Chicago Progressive Media Network at Grace Place in downtown Chicago on November 7, 2009. Media Democracy Day in Chicago, part of an international effort for Media Democracy Day originating in 1996, billed itself as a panel and workshop event which seeks to promote media access to all segments of society, network with progressive and media activists and professionals, create media initiatives to strengthen dialogue around challenges facing our world, and promote media that informs the public on important issues. 13 panelists spoke for about 5 minutes each. We'll hear presentations from three of those panelists. You'll first hear a presentation I gave as a representative of the group Chicago Media Action, speaking about legislation and regulations affecting our media.
This week marks 7 years since the founding of the group I'm representing today, Chicago Media Action, CMA. Yay! Happy birthday. Thank you. A full recounting of CMA's history is online at chicagomediaaction.org, but one common theme to many CMA campaigns is what I like to refer to as pushing the first domino. You can stand dominoes on end in lines where a push of a single gun domino causes one domino after another to fall. And I think that is emblematic of a lot of CMA's work in the sense that we have taken media policy issues that were and are important yet not very widely known, even among activists, and have worked to help raise their awareness. The hope is that increased popular awareness can lead to increased popular involvement at key points in media policy work, particularly when media policy on the whole tends away from public awareness and involvement. This domino metaphor, however, fails in one crucial respect. It's pretty easy to push a single actual domino, but pushing that first domino on media issues is quite hard, since it can take a lot of effort to get even potential allies up to speed. Luckily, that has improved dramatically in the past 7 years, and not a moment too soon, since we all faced a historic opportunity in what media scholar Bob McChesney has termed a critical juncture. A critical juncture is a rare and brief period in a society where it's possible to dramatically change the institutions that produce media, far more than possible outside a critical juncture. Critical junctures occur when any two of the following three phenomena occur at once. One, there is a revolutionary new communications technology that undermines the existing system. Two, there is the content of the present media system is seen as illegitimate and discredited. And three, there is a major political crisis where the existing order is no longer working, and there are major movements for social reform. If you have all three of these phenomena at once, you not only have a critical juncture, but one with a much higher potential for setting institutions that provide better media. So do we have a critical juncture right now with all of these criteria? Well, there is a revolutionary new communications technology that undermines the existing system, the internet. The content of the media system currently is widely seen as illegitimate and discredited. And there is a major political crisis. The financial system imploded over the past 16 months, affecting now whole industries, including media, and whatever remains is propped up through massive government bailouts. Are there major movements for social reform? The answer seems to be maybe. Considering the activism on, you name it, healthcare, the environment, foreign policy, the economy, and media. Are they major? It depends on your definition. I think the definition should be, do we even have to debate the question? If we have to, the answer then would be, no, they're not major. If not, we have to continue to work until a debate of the question is unnecessary. But there is reason for hope. So I would like to now list 6 media policy fronts that I expect to be spheres of work in the coming years, perhaps for CMA, and hopefully for everyone here, to improve the odds to build those major movements. 1, establish net neutrality. Congress and the FCC are poised to implement into law policies to preserve the principle of non-interference of content by internet service providers, what's called net neutrality. Comcast, AT&T, and Verizon will certainly lobby hard against it, but the momentum is on the side of the angels this time. But we have to keep at it. 2, improve radio. It's very likely that Congress will pass the Local Community Radio Act, which, coupled with upcoming FCC windows in high-powered radio, are poised to improve radio by expanding the number of locally responsive radio channels across the country. Odds are good on this front as well, but we have to keep the ball rolling here too. 3, Defend public access television. Access channels like Chicago's CanTV are under threat by state video franchises over the past 5 years, which removed local control and local funding of cable franchisees, ostensibly to reduce price and increase competition, but which do neither. There is momentum, including legislation introduced by Tammy Baldwin on this front as well to help turn this around. But more work is quickly needed lest we see outlets like CanTV disappear. And we've seen a number of public access centers around the country already disappear. 4, establish nonprofit journalism. Some seeds for this are being sown now with nonprofit journalism efforts like ProPublica and Democracy Now. But we can draw on nonprofit media efforts from overseas, and especially with a mismanagement crisis plaguing the American newspaper industry, the time is ripe for further efforts. 5, expand activist efforts into other social and media spheres. The main motivation for founding U.S. Network Media was to cover boxing and the World Series, and sports media remains a cash cow for major media. Also, the domestic video game industry now draws higher annual profits than Hollywood. But there are negligible activist efforts on sports media, the video games industry, and other such spheres long ignored by progressives. There are some incipient efforts like those of the group Games for Change and that of sports columnist Dave Zirin, but we have to expand work on these fronts. And 6, establish public sector broadcasting. Commercial television broadcasting profits have dramatically fallen in the past year, to the point where major media outlets have begun questioning the idea of even continuing broadcast TV. The beginning of the end may happen soon. Comcast is currently in talks to acquire NBC Universal, and with NBC in fourth place in the ratings, Comcast, if it completes the buyout, could make NBC just another cable channel. And if Comcast does that, CBS might well follow. The end result? What's been called free TV might disappear altogether in the United States in the coming decade, so that anyone in America who watches TV would have to pay for it. But this fact can be a linchpin of a nonprofit TV sector in America. After all, we're paying for TV, so why shouldn't we have our money go to broadband-based public service broadcasting in the United States that have more of a say in our media, rather than to private, unaccountable fiefdoms in the cable, satellite, and telecom industries? These are the stakes. Who will organize around these realms in this critical juncture in the coming days, months, and years? The more people get involved, the better our chances. Dziękuję bardzo, na wszyscy. Thank you.
The next presenter is Veronica Ariola, Chicago area educator and blogger.
Thank you for having me here. I wear many hats in my life, and today the hats I'm wearing is community organizer, blogger, media activist. I've been with a national group called Women in Media News since about 2002. And we're a national media analysis, education, and advocacy group. And our main mission is to increase the presence and power of women in the media justice movement, as well as the media producers. We are often the people who make meetings like this a tad bit more uncomfortable, because if we look around the room and look at our panel, there are still people who are missing at this table and in this room and in this conversation. And we need to keep those things in mind when we organize, when we continue to have these conversations and continue to build on it. And I think this is a great representation from other meetings I've been at. So we just continue to keep building on that. Some of the work that we do also is to talk with other feminist and women-led organizations to educate and talk to them about how media justice really is a women's issue. In the last 2-3 weeks, I think there's been a lot of conversation about the Maria Shriver report, the Women's Nation report, how women are now 50% of the workforce, and thus how our society, its laws and regulations and all the things that we do really don't reflect that reality. From workforce, from our representation in the media, and all of those sorts of things. So then that's why we talk to women's organizations about media being a women's issue. If we're talking about unemployment, we need to be talking about how that impacts women's jobs, as well as not in replace of how men's jobs have been lost, but how does that impact women's jobs? Just because we have more jobs does not mean that we have better jobs. We have low-wage jobs. And In terms of my community organizing, my case study would be I'm the co-chair of the Chicago Abortion Fund. For the last 3 years or 3 or 4 years, we have been reaching out to the women that we have been giving grants to. After they have their procedure, we give them a call and we call and check, make sure they're okay, they're cool. They might need a little bit of resources, we let them know where they can find them. We call them again a few weeks later, check on them. We don't just give them money and say goodbye, good luck. So we do those sorts of things. We keep calling back. After a couple of months, we invite them to our leadership group. And this leadership group is made up right now of all very young, late teens, early 20s, black women from the South Side, some from the West Side, who have come together. They come together on a monthly basis to empower themselves. They really do, as a group, empower themselves. And I've worked with them to infuse media justice into that empowerment. So the last couple of years, they've been blogging at chicagoabortionfund.blogspot.com. They have a monthly Can TV show that we have been putting up on YouTube. So they have, on a monthly basis, they have a half-hour Can TV show where they talk about abortion. These are poor, young, black women on Can TV talking about abortion. And if you are familiar with the reproductive rights movement, there's a lot of talk a lot of times about where are the women of color? Where are the women telling their stories? They're on Can TV every month, and they're on YouTube, so everyone else can see. We talk to them through Women in Media News. I talk with them and other organizations about how to use media. From writing letters to the editor, op-eds, responding to things like that. Just this past week, the Chicago Tribune had a horrible editorial about the parental notification law that is still up in the air in Illinois, and they said it was a great medium. Well, it's not. And so a lot of us wrote letters to the editor. I should have one of my letters in the paper on Monday, as well as the ACLU. So we try to educate and help teach this skill, that it is not, those of you, hopefully everyone in this room has written a letter to the editor, you know it's not rocket science. It's very basic, very simple, but we just need to continue to teach others that it's that. And that sometimes it takes 50 letters to the editor to get one printed. So it doesn't matter whose letter is printed, it's just as long as some letter is printed. And also through Women in Media and News, we talk a lot about accountability, holding corporate media, alternative media, left media accountable for the way they portray women. Huffington Post has some really great pieces, but their entertainment section is horribly sexist. They have, if you've never been there, they have sections where they ask you to try and figure out whose breasts are real. Close-ups of Hollywood stars who may or may not have had plastic surgery. That is unacceptable. Talking about, we hold left media accountable for degrading the debate over Sarah Palin to a sexist thing. Let's talk about her policies, not whether or not she was a beauty queen. Talking about Hillary Clinton on her policies, not whether or not you think she's a bitch. Also about diversity at the table, as I said, as well as the people who are giving those opinions in whatever medium there are. So that is where I am. Thank you so much.
That was Veronica Ariola. The next panelist is Robert Kohler, peace journalist and syndicated newspaper columnist.
Well, just to tell you a little bit about who I am, career journalist in Chicago, so that spans 30-some years at this point. I cut my teeth in the neighborhoods on the north side of the city at the late great Lerner newspapers, and for about 14 years until this past May, I was an editor at Tribune Media Services, which is the Tribune Syndicate. I was laid off in May, but I still write a column, a nationally syndicated column. I've been doing that column for 10 years. I consider myself a peace journalist, whatever that means, and I'm not even sure what that means, but I know that it means listening to people and telling the truth. When I started my career, I would say one of the biggest surprises that I had was that how grateful people were when I just listened to them. And I think this is where it begins, and this is what the media somehow needs to be about this more than it is. And I know, I mean, I've been part of an industry that has been falling apart pretty much since I've been in it. And, you know, I mean, and the giants are now tottering and reeling and, you know, and God knows what's going to happen to papers and empires like the Chicago Tribune. I have mixed feelings. I want young people to be able to find a career as writers and journalists. I think that's crucial. And if the papers collapse, that will be, something will come up, but it'll be hard to make a living. Okay, let me just cut quickly to the chase. I only have a couple of minutes. What do we need? What does the media need? I mean, I've begun the process of reimagining our media. You know, the print media. That's what I'm most familiar with. I'll just read a few points that just to throw them out there. A re-envisioned media must learn to tell complex stories simply and compellingly. This requires a reorientation toward truth and away from lowest common denominator journalism. Fear-mongering, celebrity fawning, and other forms of know-nothingism that have only gotten worse in recent years as the reeling media empires grow ever more desperate for quick and cheap profits. The media need to grow up. Reporters must stop flailing the good versus evil, winner versus loser narrative, which explains nothing, justifies everything, and only fuels the moneyed status quo. In this column that I wrote, I talked about my friend Jake Lynch, an Australian journalist, who, as far as I know, is the one who coined the term peace journalism, which looks at all sides of a conflict, examines all consequences of violence, including military violence, and pursues the why of a story beyond the official sources, which are usually anonymous, and which turns most war reportage into propaganda. And finally, the media must expand their horizons and find an intelligence independent of the experts they so often quote to avoid saying anything. And I'm speaking here about my particular interest, which is the coverage of violence, which is, of course, endemic in our culture and in on the planet. And we haven't begun to understand what violence is all about. The media must try to understand and learn to write about the real news that people crave. 30 seconds, okay. I'm almost done here. Sometimes unknowingly, this is the news about social and environmental healing. Right now, the media doesn't even recognize healing as news. And yet without it, we have no future. Anyway, these are some ideas that I want to toss into the stew of this meeting this afternoon. And I am very interested in hearing what everybody else has to say. So thank you very much.
That was Robert Kohler. Audio and video excerpts of these and other panelists are now online at the website of the Metro Chicago Progressive Media Network at www.chicagoprogmedia.org. That's www.chicagoprogmedia.org. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of The Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.